Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
It is a service of consecration. It does have this very specific and, in today's society, very controversial Christian theological meaning. How can it function as the moment of the investiture of the head of state of the entire United Kingdom?
The accession of Charles provided us with a certain stability. We had that extraordinary political craziness. The Queen shook the hand of Boris Johnson and the hand of Liz Truss as one went and the other came in. Within a few weeks, not long after she died, we had Rishi Sunak. Turmoil, political turmoil. But meantime, the monarchy provided continuity and stability, and that was highlighted by that political turmoil.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable, the show that tries to get Christians and non-Christians thinking. I'm Roger Bolton, and this week we're going to discuss whether the church and state should be bound together or separated. The reason for discussing this now is, of course, the coronation of King Charles III, to whom the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has suggested we pay homage, a suggestion that raised a considerable number of eyebrows. Well, to discuss the role of monarchy and the coronation in the 21st century, I'm joined by Catherine Pepinster, Catholic columnist and former editor of The Tablet, and she's the author of Defenders of the Faith, The British Monarchy, Religion and the Next Coronation, and by Dr. Jonathan Chaplin. He's a fellow of Wesley House, Cambridge, and the author of Beyond Establishment, Resetting Church-State Relations in England. You can discover lots more content at premierunbelievable.com, and we always love hearing from you, our listeners. So please get in touch and tell us what you think. Of course, you can write to us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can follow the show and comment on Twitter at unbelievable, capital F, capital E, or you can follow us on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And now let's get back to our discussion with Catherine Pepinster and Dr. Jonathan Chaplin. Welcome to you both. Thank you very much for participating in this discussion. And let me start by asking, if I may, Catherine Pepinster, what has Christianity got to do, being the religion of the powerful, as opposed to supporting the powerless? Why is it part of the establishment and not part of, if you like, the revolutionary movement which some believe Jesus put in trace?
We'd have to look at the world history of Christianity to explain much of that. But in Britain, there has been a link between the monarchy and Christianity for as long as there are documentary records. The first coronation of which there's written evidence was that of King Edgar in 973. The monarch Edgar was anointed and crowned then by the bishops. That process continued. There was that mutual connection between the monarchy and Christianity.
But you're describing, if I may, something which happens in the 8th century. What about the first three centuries of Christianity? The church, there was no king involved, and it's not until Constantine comes along as emperor that a sort of deal is done in which Christianity is recognized as the state religion, and in return, the Christianity seems to support the state. Is that the crucial moment, do you think, Catherine Pepinster, when this relationship begins?
Yes, I would say so. It's built upon. more and more till we get to this stage that I'm talking about.
The state gets the backing of the Christian Church to support the status quo, and the Church gets something, a position in that state, security and a place of safety. It's a marriage of convenience, not necessarily religiously significant at this moment, is it?
Not an expert in the history of Christianity in its earliest days. But what we see in Britain is an acceptance of the tenets of Christianity. Some people might say that it uses Christianity to be a kind of form of social control, if you like. What you also see in the early days of Christianity, say in the Middle Ages, you see something going on that actually does benefit the people as well, because you see Christianity providing welfare, for example, through the religious houses. So it is benefiting the ordinary person.
Can I bring in Dr. Jonathan Kaplan at this point and go back to the origins, the beginnings of Christianity? Am I right in suggesting that essentially it is, to begin with, a religion, if you like, of the relatively powerless?
Absolutely correct, yes. The early church congregations that were formed after the events of Christ on earth were indeed consisting mostly of those on the margins of society, those without power, the outcasts. There were some exceptions. There were Roman officials, there were centurions and others. But on the whole, these congregations were made up of those that lacked political and social power, often quite poor. Hence, you find stories of intercongregational financial aid recorded in the Acts of the Apostles, because many congregations, particularly those in Jerusalem, actually, which was a very poor society at that time, needed help. So yes, you're quite right about that. And that was the case for quite a while. Over time, of course, as Christianity spread, it penetrated into a wider range of social classes and eventually won support in some sections of the imperial establishment. The critical moment was when the Emperor Constantine underwent a conversion. In fact, he did not at that point make Christianity the state religion. He granted toleration to Christianity, which was absolutely epical, because for the first time, Christianity no longer had to fear state persecution. A successor emperor, Emperor Theodosius, is the one who made Christianity the state religion. And that, in my view, as a critic of these arrangements, is where the trouble really started.
Well, the trouble or safety for Christians, you could argue it the other way.
I certainly don't mean that safety was not an important consideration, and that was absolutely critical. That was a huge achievement. And at the time, many Christians and theologians saw this as an amazing providential intervention by God to protect the church. But by the time of Theodosius, he made Christianity the compulsory religion of the whole empire.
After three centuries of persecution, the offer of protection, essentially, from the state must have been, because the alternative was continued persecution. But in doing so, Catherine Pepinster, do you think that this alliance was forged, which still continues? It continues in Russia today, for example, with the Russian Orthodox Church and Vladimir Putin. This connection of church and state was formed, which, you know, in a way, supported forms of nationalism, not internationalism.
We certainly see that happen in Britain, in England, when we have the Reformation and Henry VIII decides that rather than be linked to the Roman Catholic Church, he founds his own church. He creates the Church of England. And I think it's fair to say it is an expression of English nationalism. And we see how that develops over the years. It becomes a stronger and stronger aspect of the link between the monarchy and the Church of England. We see the Church of England go abroad alongside the British Empire, becomes the church, if you like, of the empire, spreading Anglicanism. And we also see it back in Britain with the oaths that are then taken by the monarch at the coronation, which express how the monarch is going to uphold the settlement of the Church of England and maintain what it describes as the Protestant Reformed religion. So very interestingly, nowadays in England, that part of Britain, we see more and more people using the English flag, the Cross of St. George, if you look at film of the 1966 World Cup, which England won, back then, it wasn't the Cross of St. George that would fly at matches by supporters. It was the Union flag. But all the way through, the churches flew the English flag, the Cross of St. George. They expressed that Englishness through their church towers.
So we're talking about this religion and nationalism sort of going together. And I suppose when, Jonathan Kaplan, when one looks back and turns to the medieval ages and so on, the choice was essentially between anarchy and peace and stability, within which the church could get on with all of those things it wanted to. And as Catherine has said earlier, looking after the poor, the sick, it was virtually the church, the NHS of the Middle Ages. It was only able to do that with a peaceful realm. So that relationship between the church and the state there, that it's a necessary connection for the church to carry out what it thinks it ought to do, to have that relationship with the state.
Well, I think I'd make a fundamental distinction between protection and privilege. So yes, the church throughout the ages has sought and has been entitled to protection by whatever were the governing authorities of the time. Sometimes it's had it, and sometimes it hasn't, and sometimes it's been overtly persecuted by those authorities. But certainly it's a fundamental obligation of all political authorities to provide protection for Christianity and other religions that are in its territory. That's a universal obligation. That does not mean that the church should be uniquely established or uniquely privileged. It's perfectly possible to imagine, and there have been regimes in which all religions or many religions find proper protection to carry on to do those missional activities that Catherine has alluded to without having a constitutional advantage.
Yes, I want to come to that later, if I may. But talking about the Middle Ages, there was no alternative, really.
Yeah.
It's a kingdom or it's nothing. So the church has to have that relationship. The idea of the divine right of kings is developed, and one particularly looks at James I, perhaps, of England, 6th of Scotland, who is possessed of this idea. His son, Charles I, seems even more so, and that ends up with his head being cut off. But where did the idea of the divine right of kings come from, and does it linger a little today?
Well, it emerged from various philosophers, theologians, that James was particularly enamoured of, and you could probably see it in the Tudors as well, without it being overtly expressed, but it was the Stuarts who brought it with them from Scotland, this notion that usually the king, occasionally the queen, regnant, the king had this connection with God, and that if you crossed the king, you crossed God. The relationship between God and the monarch was so essential. Defying a monarch meant you defied the divine as well.
And is that a sense that the monarch was an intermediary between God and the people? He's not in heaven, he's not in earth, he's somewhere between the two.
You just asked about whether that lingers, and in some ways I think it does. I don't for a moment believe that Charles III thinks that anybody who crosses him crosses God, but there's a way in which the church seems to express that. There will come a moment, for example, in the moment of crowning, Charles will be dressed up. He will wear what Buckingham Palace are effectively calling vestments. He will wear priestly garb, as if he is the intermediary between God and the people in the way a priest is.
And then there will be a moment, won't there? Anybody there will not see what is happening when he is secluded. There is a moment too sacred for the rest of us to see, a moment between him, God, and the Archbishop.
Yes, and Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has described that moment you're talking about, that secluded private moment, as a meeting between the King and the King of Kings, meaning Jesus. So I find that particularly intriguing, given that this is a Protestant religion that is crowning this king, a religion founded by people who wanted to get away from much of what the Catholic Church was about. And yet this idea of there being this intermediary remained essential through the monarch himself.
Jonathan, can I bring you in here? The divine right of kings goes away because the Civil War interrupts the process. Charles I is executed, the condition when Charles II comes to the throne, it's very much on condition that he does not invoke anything like the divine right of kings. And then we get to his brother, James II, who becomes a Catholic, at which point there's a coup. The Protestant coup, isn't it? James II goes through a coronation. There's no suggestion that he is not a Christian. But because he's a Catholic, it can't be dealt with. We can't have that. So we have what the Protestant historians call a glorious revolution. And then subsequently, when we have William and Mary, then we have Anne, then Anne doesn't have any surviving children, we find, I think somebody is about 40th in the line of succession, and we put him in as king because he's a Protestant. Now, it's difficult then to believe, isn't it, that there's a divine right that continues through all this process.
Yes, I mean, we have to distinguish between the theology of divine right and the hereditary principle of monarchy. The two are not necessarily connected at all, although historically they have been taken to be connected. So, in other words, there's been an assumption that whoever is the rightful monarch in terms of hereditary, then that person is appointed by God. Now, I think it's also important to distinguish, both in the past and today, between the specific theology of the divine right of kings, which peaked around about 16th, 17th centuries and carried on until the French Revolution finally killed it off across Europe, and the divine appointment of kings. So the idea that the kings or political authorities were appointed to a vocation by God goes back to St. Paul, indeed to the Hebrew Bible. So this is not a new idea, and it's not an inherently authoritarian idea. That idea that kings were monarchs, princes were appointed by God to a vocation to do justice for the people goes right back to the beginning of Christianity, and it's something that I would want to affirm very much today, and it's found its way powerfully again into the liturgy that we're about to celebrate next week. But the divine right of kings, in my view, was a heretical departure from the mainstream tradition of Christian political thought. And so I'm glad that it's dead. Nobody wants to revive it. Everybody today understands kingship and political authority as conditional upon the proper discharge of the vocation of the political ruler, which is to do justice, to promote the common good, to promote peace, and so forth.
Catherine Pepinster, as a Roman Catholic, are you offended by the Protestant takeover of the monarchy?
The king is banned from being a Catholic himself, as is any other person who succeeds to the throne.
Is that offensive to you? And do you see what I described perhaps as a sort of Protestant takeover as something which was fundamentally, I can't use the word illegal, but wrong?
I think there is a way in which Catholics find the emphasis on Protestantism that remains within the coronation is there. You notice it. So this time, unusually, the king will swear an additional oath under the terms of something called the Accession Declaration Act. Something that normally monarchs do at the first state opening of Parliament of their reign. But the coronation is coming before the first state opening of Parliament of his reign. So there's going to be oaths about maintaining the Protestant Reformed religion and upholding the Church of England. And then there's going to be this statement where he says, I am a faithful Protestant. It's hard to explain why that somebody saying, keep using Protestant, somehow feels more notable than somebody talking about the Church of England. I can't explain it, but I know that Catholics notice this. We should be grateful, however, that they have adjusted what they say under the Accession Declaration Act, because it was amended in 1910. They took out the denunciation of transubstantiation and of the Virgin Mary.
You're grateful for small mercies then, are you?
Indeed. But the thing that you notice when you look at how these things have developed is that the people involved in making these decisions are often very pragmatic. So they got rid of those more offensive parts when there were issues with Home Rule and Ireland. So they thought, we're not going to keep the Irish Catholics on side if we go around denouncing the Virgin Mary. So politics always comes into this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, come back to Jonathan. Let's say we're now in the 19th century. And now what I was struck was how near we came to be a republic in the 19th century. We had a very unpopular queen, Victoria. A number of assassination attempts on her. She withdrew after the death of her husband. It was, in some people say, the invention of, by Disraeli, of this title empress. And she became the figurehead and throughout the world, and therefore the Anglican Communion and so on. She becomes this sort of figure. And of course, the United States made sure that God and the state were separated. You have the French Republic and so on. And you also have this situation in the rest of Europe where there are still monarchies, but they don't, for example, have a coronation. Why do you think we still have a monarchy? What was it that enabled people to hold on to that when elsewhere people are saying this belongs to the past?
Well, in England and Britain, one of the proximate reasons for that is that after the 17th century, we never really had a revolution or never had a threat of revolution. We may have had critics of the monarchy peaking in the Victorian period, but there was never a radical rupture of the kind that affected many other European states. And some of those states, of course, are still being formed until the 19th century. Germany, Italy, and so forth, didn't really have a settled territory. So monarchs were on much more fragile ground over there. It was the French Revolution, of course, which then triggered a number of liberal revolutions in other European states. That never happened in Britain, so there was no point of radical discontinuity where the nation suddenly had to think to itself, now what? So tradition prevailed, and we are where we are today. That's essentially, I think, what happened. And in addition, we had a well-established, early on, we had quite a well-established constitutional monarchy. That is a non-arbitrary, a non-authoritarian monarchy that deferred to Parliament. So that gave it far greater legitimacy as we began to enter the democratic age. That process was much less straightforward in other European states. And so that's, I think, one reason why. We've had a, on the whole, by comparison, a pretty good constitutional monarchy that made its peace with democracy quite early and so has then been allowed to survive since then. It is true that we are the only European country that has not just a coronation, but a sacral coronation. So no other European monarchies are crowned any longer. And it's been a very long time since they were crowned in the context of a religious service.
Do you find that strange, Catherine Pepinster, that we are now, England, is the only country which has a coronation?
I'm not sure if finding it strange is the issue, really. I think that if you got it, then flaunt it. The eyes of the world will be upon us. The thing that's evident with having a monarchy is that it can be a form of soft power, that people are drawn to Britain because of it, that the monarch and certain other members of the royal family, the working world, are made use of a lot by the Foreign Office. So I think it's a way that Britain can have some influence.
How essential is it to the life of Christians in this country that there should be a monarch?
Well, that's clearly a question which the king has been asking himself in his preparation for this coronation. They have tried to modernise it to a certain extent so that it does appear to matter more to people who aren't just members of the Church of England, but who are members of other Christian denominations and other faiths. I don't think that it matters in that people are going to be necessarily drawn to Christianity because there's a coronation. But I think that if they looked at it more deeply, they may find something within it that expresses what Christianity is about. Again, I think the King and the Archbishop of Canterbury have tried to make it more evident this time round by talking about how the coronation has a theme. The theme is called to serve. That idea of service has been evident in previous coronations without being so overtly highlighted or labelled.
Thank you very much, Catherine. If we could just take a quick break here, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Roger Bolton, and my guests today are writer, journalist and author of Defenders of the Faith, Catherine Pepinster, and Dr. Jonathan Chaplin, author of Beyond Establishment, Resetting Church-State Relations in England. See you in a moment.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back. Today we're discussing the religious significance of the coronation of King Charles and whether or not it's feasible in a multicultural society to have an established church. Let me start perhaps with you, Jonathan Chaplin. This coronation service is meant to be for the whole country, well, the United Kingdom, and yet it is a fundamentally Christian service, and Christianity, as we know, is declining quite rapidly, and indeed the attendance at Church of England places of worship are declining as well. This is a tricky problem for the church and Charles to solve, isn't it?
Of course it is. I'm sure they've been wrestling with this privately for months and years. But it's an issue for the nation as a whole. It's not something that can be resolved behind closed doors. So it's true, fewer than 3% of the British population are now active members of the Church of England. And yet the Church of England finds itself in this very unusual role of presiding over the investiture of the head of state of the whole of the UK, not just England, but Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, and of course, all of those nations are profoundly multicultural and multi-faith. The recent census made clear that for the first time now, only a minority of British people self-identify as Christian. So this creates an obvious and pretty deep incongruity, and one would have thought that this would force state and church to ask some basic questions about the continuation of establishment as a whole, not just the coronation. I see no signs in the leadership of either state or church to have that discussion. And I think it's long overdue. And once the dust has settled after Saturday, I think we urgently need to pick that question up.
Well, we'll urgently pick it up in the last section of our discussion. But if I could move to you, Catherine, you know a great deal about what goes on behind the veil or whatever it is. This argument about defender of faith, defender of faiths, that was a very real argument. And there were people who thought that now King Charles believed that he should be a defender of faiths. How has that been resolved? Was that a real argument, do you think? And how has it been resolved for the coronation?
This is a very interesting one. That comment that he made 30 years ago when he said, I want to be defender of faith rather than defender of the faith when the time comes, it really did bother senior clergy within the Church of England. I personally find rather an irony about that because, of course, that title was given to an English monarch by a pope. It was given to Henry VIII.
But that's after Henry VIII wrote a document which the Pope thought was a wonderful defence of the Roman Catholic Church.
Indeed, yes. It was a riposte to Martin Luther. Within a few years, Henry had cleared off himself, but the monarchs of this country have held that title ever since. And because it's been a Protestant monarchy for so long, people think Defender of the Faith is about defending Protestantism. 30 years ago, certain Anglican clergy get very upset about this, and it's certainly something that people remember that Charles said, it's lingered. Some years ago, he did say, I'm going to actually stick with Defender of the Faith.
But in the construction of the service, they've sort of bent over backwards while keeping that statement, well, to make it as inclusive as possible, to recognise the reality that the biggest growing religion, for example, in this country is Islam.
What has been going on, and it wasn't noticed when this started to happen in his mother's time, is that the monarch, who's also got the title, of course, of Supreme Governor of the Church of England, has been reinventing what the Church of England is about. So in 2012, Elizabeth II gave a speech at Lambeth Palace, the home of the Archbishop of Canterbury, where she talked about how the Church of England was created to enable other faiths to live freely. Well, actually, I don't think so, Your Majesty.
No, no.
But that was then embraced by the Church of England with gusto. And the Accession Council and the proclamations was announced as Defender of the Faith. Then, effectively picking up on what his mother had been saying at a reception soon after he became king, he said he has a duty to protect faith. So they've been rewriting what the Church of England and the monarchy is about. And that's coming through in this coronation. And they are promoting how it's coming through. But actually, when you look at the service as a whole, these gestures towards other faiths and even other Christian denominations is absolutely minimal. And this is yet again about the Church of England. And this coronation puts the Church of England right back in the spotlight.
Jonathan, there'll be a number of Anglicans who will be delighted with that. There'll be quite another large number of other people who will be concerned about it. And there may be a large number who are entirely indifferent. But the Archbishop of Canterbury has asked us to pay homage. He didn't tell us to. He said you might like to pay homage to the king. And I think for a lot of people, this was rather strange because they associate homage being with something that a vassal would do. And I think the Archbishop has tried to say, no, it's not quite like that. But what do you make of this request? I mean, will you, for example, be paying homage?
Well, I'll be watching events in my front room on the telly with members of my family popping in and out. So I can't imagine myself joining in the cry of allegiance from the sandpit of my sofa. No, I think this is a bit of absurd performance, frankly. I can't find it to be a meaningful element of the coronation at all. It will be largely meaningless to the vast majority of people who are actually watching. And of course, there's many more who will not be watching. It's a rather empty gesture, I think. It's an attempt to sort of add a democratic element to the monarchy, but I think it's really quite clunky and ham-fisted, so very, very problematic. It's very important, if I can make this point, it's very important that citizens of the UK, in all the four nations of the UK, have a strong sense of identification with the UK, with the political community of which we're members. There are many, many things that need to be done to strengthen that sense of identification. And it needs also to be a critical identification so that we as the people are empowered and encouraged to call governors, not just the king. The king is only a ceremonial governor, to call governments and parliaments to account for how they discharge their duties of justice and the common good. It's crucial that we have processes and resources put to empower citizens to identify and criticise their political communities in the interests of justice and the common good. This, I think, is not one of them.
Catherine Pepinster, will you be paying homage?
I don't think so. I find this is a really strange thing that they've decided to do. So we kept being told in advance of the coronation details being released that this coronation was going to be more modern, that it was going to be more contemporary, they were going to get rid of what Rowan Williams described to me as the Gilbert and Sullivan.
That's the
element.
Former Archbishop of Canterbury, the predecessor of the present
indeed,
one.
Indeed. One of the Gilbert and Sullivan elements they have got rid of was having a lot of aristocrats, dukes, etc. present. And one thing that used to happen was that those people would pay homage to the king. So they've said, oh, let's get rid of that. I know, let's have homage of the people instead. Oh, that's very modern, homage of the people. But they've chosen homage of the people to be about swearing allegiance to Charles and his successors. People in this country don't tend to swear allegiance to the monarch. I think the idea of swearing allegiance, some people think it's very American, the swearing allegiance to the flag or whatever. I think it's both a risky thing for them to suggest people do. Risky because I don't think many people are going to do it. And I also think it shows that they have focused, they've talked amongst themselves and not thought about how this is going to be seen by other people. If they'd, you know, had some kind of focus group about this or poll, I think they'd have found that this won't go down very well.
As UK citizens, we can't pledge ourselves to the Constitution because we don't have a written Constitution.
Well, there's that problem.
So it's difficult.
I mean, this is actually rather like what members of the armed forces do. They swear allegiance to the monarch.
That perpetuates the fiction that the king could, for example, decide if we were going to go to war, which, of course, an American president can, but a king can't do that. It is a sort of fiction. If I move on to what the Archbishops of Canterbury and York have written about the service, and they say, the coronation is steeped in this country's traditions and filled with great symbolism. It is essentially a consecration to service, happening within a Eucharist, the most basic and the central act of Christian worship. It includes oaths, regalia, and crowning, though through it we receive from Jesus, the one who comes to us as a servant, the one who is King of Kings. So, do you believe this is a sacrament? That is the heart of the coronation, Catherine Pepinster.
I think I do accept that, yes. In studying the coronation service of previous times and this one now, That comes through, I think. The sacramental aspect of it, I would say, is the moment of anointing when they touch the king, the Archbishop of Canterbury touch the king on his head, the palms of his hands and his breast with oil and will say prayers. This is something that we see in sacraments in the Christian churches. Oil is used at baptism, confirmation, priestly ordination. To use the words of the old Roman Catholic Penny Catechism, sacrament is an outward sign of inward grace. And I can see how this ceremony reflects it. So what it's saying is that this person has all the flaws and vulnerabilities typical of a human being and needs to be sustained in order to carry out his duties. And I think that's, you know, for a Christian, that makes sense. It's also seen within the context of a service of communion. And a service of communion commemorates Jesus Christ and the sacrifice, the service that he gave. So it links the role of the monarch to the example of Christ. And I find that myself affecting, yeah.
And Jonathan Chaplin, do you think it's a sacrament? Also, do you think it's a way of the church telling the king, don't get above yourself, there's a King of Kings and it's not you, so remember, you also are a subject of the divine?
Well, that's what the church intends by this service. Certainly, it intends it as a sacramental moment. Different Christian traditions will have different theologies of that. It's not one of the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church. It's not one of the two central sacraments of the Anglican Church. But one could say it has a sacramental overlay or meaning. It is indeed a service of consecration. But I think I want to just stand back and pose the wider question of, given that it does have this very specific and, let's face it, in today's society, very controversial Christian theological meaning, how can it function as the moment of the investiture of the head of state of the entire United Kingdom? I want to ask the question, how many people out there in the nation, how many citizens can actually identify with this moment in which their head of state is formally invested? Strikes me that we're talking about very low percentages of citizens. And therefore, from my point of view, although I've read the liturgy and it's rich with deep Christian meaning, which I personally can resonate with and mostly affirm, I am concerned that it effectively marginalizes and excludes the vast majority of the population, even those who might be notionally Christian, But certainly those who are not Christian, who may be committed to secular humanism or other faiths, which are, you know, incompatible with Christianity, where does that leave them? How can they fully identify with such a service?
Could I stop you just for a moment and ask Catherine Pepperster how she responds to what Jonathan has said? How can those people who are not Christian identify with this?
I think that there are two things. One is what they're hoping is that people will respond to it, which isn't quite the same thing as identifying with it. And you could respond to it even if you're not Christian because of the ceremonial. You may be drawn into it because of the music. But they are trying to also find a way to enable people to identify with it even more than just respond to it by emphasizing this idea of service, this idea that we work for others. People who don't believe in God may find it difficult to understand why people would want to serve God.
It's also difficult when it's been reported that Monica's a billionaire. I just wonder how if you're a, nobody's an ordinary person in the street or whatever, but this seems to be something that's happening in the capital, in Westminster Abbey. It's surrounded by mystery. It's surrounded by certain views of faith. It's crowning a person who is an uncommon person, shall we say. And finding that connection back to the community as a whole is very difficult. In 1953, or actually even with the Jubilee of the Queen, the emotion was palpable, the love, the affection was palpable. People felt they were a real sense of coming together. I don't know how religious or otherwise it might have been, but there certainly was an acknowledgement that the Queen received and should have this respect, largely. Some wouldn't agree with this. With this coronation, something else is happening, isn't it? There's a greater sense of, should this continue or not? There's a greater sense of doubt and questioning. Would you, Catherine Pepperster, agree?
I think there is more doubt, definitely. They keep talking about us being a more diverse nation, and by that they mean ethnic and religious differences, but we're also a more diverse nation because there are more people who don't accept that there should be a monarchy. Yes, we are diverse, and that's a problem for them, but I think they are trying to find a way through, and I think this emphasis on service is part of it. I understand what you're saying about how wealthy the king is, and people for whom that's the primary consideration, yes, will probably be alienated. But the monarchy, not just now as they plan for this coronation, but the monarchy for quite some years, has emphasised more and more its connection with what we might call civil society. The academic Frank Prochaska talked about it being a welfare monarchy, that it's linked to post-war, the welfare state, in that the Queen went around opening hospitals or whatever, and also it's a welfare monarchy in that they are allied to philanthropic works, charity, etc., through their patronages. And I think that's what they're trying to emphasise through this coronation. So there'll be large numbers of guests who have links with the philanthropy that they're engaged in, the charitable works. And some of that charitable work, it's not just about going around being Lady Bountiful and paying for a guide dog. It's about what goes on via the Prince's Trust in the inner cities, etc. So they have tried to find a function that works in the kind of society that we're in now.
The impression I get is that in the run-up to the coronation, there's been a tug of war, if you like, between all the elements involved and the Church of England trying to be as generous as possible, but pulling this thing back into being essentially an Anglican experience. And of course, one of the things that King Charles is the supreme governor of the Church of England. Now, Jonathan Chaplin, that term would have meant something when Henry VIII was on the throne. What does it mean now? There's no sense in which the King Charles could say to the Synod of the Church of England, one of the major synods of the Church of England, no, you can't do that. I don't agree with it. I'm the Supreme Governor. Stop. Does it have any meaning, that term now, the Supreme Governor?
So, like all royal powers, in a constitutional monarchy, these powers are exercised through the government of the day. So, of course, the monarch himself or herself has no executive authority directly over the church.
But the government does, and Parliament does. They act in the King's name. This is all part of the apparatus of establishment, of which the coronation is the most sort of visible and dramatic manifestation. So what the supreme governorship means, that the church's own internal legislation still has to be approved by Parliament by means of the ecclesiastical. But also the other manifestation is the power of crown appointments, which derives directly from the Henrician Reformation, whereby historically all senior church appointments, bishops, deans and so forth, are made by the crown. And that's still the case notionally via the Prime Minister's office, which is why when a bishop is appointed, the announcement comes not from Lambeth Palace or from the diocese, but from the Prime Minister. Now, those are parts of the legacy of the supreme governorship. So that's what it means today, and it continues to mean. And in those two expressions, both parliamentary oversight and crown appointments, we see, in my view, the continuing symbolic and the real subservience of the Church of England to the British state.
Accepting the points that Jonathan makes about the monarch having to be consulted, at least officially, just, Catherine Pepys, this supreme governor question, is it conceivable that the king could express his unhappiness with developments in liturgy or whatever at the Church of England and intervene in any way? Or the supreme governor is just a term that has a meaning in the past but not the present?
Well, there is a certain amount of engagement that goes on between the Archbishop of Canterbury and the monarch. The Archbishop of Canterbury doesn't see the monarch as frequently as the Prime Minister does. You know, there's not a weekly audience. But there are conversations that go on between them.
Are those conversations likely to materially affect anything? Or is it just, we have to go through this process of having a conversation, but actually nothing happens at the end of it?
Well, a prime example of how things do happen because of those conversations is what I was talking about earlier, when in 2012 the Queen rewrote what the Church of England was about. That didn't happen without her discussing it, or her people discussing it with the Archbishop of Canterbury's people at the time. These things do happen, so there is that connection between them, yes. It's not enormous. I mean, the monarch wouldn't say to the Archbishop of Canterbury, don't bring in same-sex blessings, but there is dialogue behind the scenes that I think does have an impact, yes.
I wonder what, finally, in this section, Jonathan Chaplin, we could talk about the wider Anglican community, which is now absolutely divided, may indeed be in the process of breaking up over issues of sexuality. Is there anything in the service or the role of the king in the Church of England that can affect this? Or does the king effectively have to be a bystander? He's supreme governor of the church, he is crowned, but in terms of uniting the Anglican communion, he's no real role.
No. So the target of anger and grief expressed by large sections of the Global South Anglican churches who met recently in Kigali to reflect on this issue, the target was the Archbishop of Canterbury and the other core instruments of the Anglican communion, not the king. There was no mention of the monarch. Rightly so. He plays no role in these global Anglican debates, and nor should he. I mean, he can continue to practice the legacy of his mother by expressing an attitude of inclusivity and openness and so forth, but this is not going to cut any ice at all with those Anglicans in the communion who are now on the point of precipitating a schism. This, I think, is going to happen. And, I mean, there's nothing, I think, that the Archbishop of Canterbury can now do about this. So if he can't do anything about it, I certainly don't think King Charles can do anything about it. The issue, if I may, of same-sex marriage, which has precipitated this, has a very significant bearing on the church's established status. And as you remember, just a few weeks before the time of General Synod, when this was discussed and decided, a group of MPs from different parties got together and essentially said to the Church of England, look, you know, if you don't bring in same-sex marriage soon, we're going to put pressure on you to do so. That's another of the implications, ironically, of King Charles being the supreme governor, because he acts through Parliament, and parliamentarians were simply exercising their constitutional rights in telling the Church of England, look, you're straying way too far away from national values. If you want to be the church of the nation,
you better fall in line.
And Catherine Pennant said, do you see any unifying role that King Charles can play in the Anglican Communion as a whole?
Well, I'd like to go back a bit. I think there is a way in which this whole issue you're talking about the Anglican Communion, has impacted on this coronation. So, as we discussed earlier, there was quite a lot of talk before the Order of Service was published about whether or not there would be much involvement of other faiths. And their role is minimal in this, absolutely minimal. And the Church of England has been very sensitive about this issue. So the other faiths' representatives, they will process in at the start. At the end, they will give the King a greeting. Now, after Lambeth Palace released the Order of Service, they then sent out a further email of clarification to say, please note that the greeting comes after the service, the religious service has ended, and that that is just ceremonial. So what they were trying to make sure was that nobody could say, this is completely unacceptable what you've done, it contravenes canon law of the Church. They cannot have said by other faiths in a Church of England church. Now, sometimes it happens and then people get their knuckles wrapped, or sometimes something can happen that's annulled because of a particular situation. So Westminster Abbey has Commonwealth Day services, it's a royal peculiar. Because of that, they only answer to the monarch, they can do what they want. But when it's a coronation, Westminster Abbey comes under the jurisdiction of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And given the pressure that Justin Welby is under from the Anglican Communion, you know, I think there was no chance that they were going to allow anything to happen that could become another stick with which to beat him by the Anglican Communion, and even more so from those people that Jonathan was talking about who belong to this organisation called GAFCON. So well, it is affecting the coronation.
Well, thank you very much for the moment, Catherine Pepinster and Jonathan Chaplin. Stay with us, because in the final section of our discussion, we're going to finally, Jonathan, give you the opportunity to make the case for the disestablishment of the Church. We'll be back just in a moment. Well, welcome back. Today we're discussing the religious significance of the coronation of Prince, now King, Charles, and whether or not it's feasible in a multicultural society to have an established church. And Jonathan Chaplin thinks it's time we didn't have an established church. Well, Jonathan, you've talked in this discussion so far about the negative reasons for change. Make the positive case for Christians in this country to de-establish the Church of England.
So the positive case is to recover the integrity, authenticity, and freedom of the Church. That's the fundamental goal. So it's a missional argument that I would like to make. The argument is not a secularist argument. It's absolutely not.
You're a Christian yourself. You're driven by your faith to make these arguments.
Yes, absolutely. At least I hope so. I hope they're consistent with my faith. I mean, I admit that it's one reading of the faith and others will disagree, but it's a long-standing reading rooted deeply in the early church, in the Reformation, and also in sections of the monastic movement in the Middle Ages, and in my view is the logic of the Declaration on Religious Liberty of Vatican II in the 1960s. So I think it has wide ecumenical appeal, potentially. One of the problems is that many of the discussions that take place in Church of England are incredibly insular and parochial, that we don't look outside of England or the UK to envisage all the different kinds of relations between church and state that can exist, and that where the church functions well and even flourishes across Europe and elsewhere in the world. We have to broaden the field of discussion and get out of our characteristically English and English Anglican insularity, which really closes our mind. So the positive case is a missionary or missional argument that the church should be free from the encroachments that come with establishment and the improper expectations of being the deferential chaplain of the nation, so that it can free its mind and heart for a more prophetic and more integral mission.
When you're saying that, more prophetic, do you mean in part freer to criticize the state political parties, and to go back, if you like, to what some would see as the original Christian message. That the suggestion is that the church is a bit bothered about doing that, and it has to, in the end, stand by the king or the prime minister. That if that was free, that would be easier. But of course, people would say, well, you don't have to belong to Church of England. You could go, you could be a Christian without being a member of the Church of England. We can do that anyway. And why not make that choice? Why not just leave the Church of England and go somewhere else? They'd be delighted to have you, doubtless.
Well, just because I disagree with the Church of England's relationship to the state doesn't mean that I shouldn't be an Anglican. I'm a lifelong Anglican, a committed Anglican. I celebrate a great deal of Anglicanism and want it to continue in England and elsewhere. So I'm not going to walk over this issue, and I'm not going to be pushed out over it. Nobody's pushing me out. Nobody's listening, really. That's the issue. You're right. The question is, what is the fundamental posture of the church vis-a-vis its surrounding culture and society? Now, it's been a long-standing debate, and lots of different views have been held. But from the early church, certainly, the posture was to be a presence within the community in which it find itself, but also a critical and at times prophetic presence within it, to enact and embody an alternative way of life following the way of Jesus, rather than to simply replicate or merge with the prevailing values, the culture round about. Now, sometimes, in different historical periods and today, the church finds that it can affirm a great deal of what contemporary culture would wish to celebrate itself. So there's a convergence, but my argument is that by being, as it were, contained within the apparatus of establishment, the church's critical imagination is stifled. So at times, of course, the church is critical. I mean, you listen to a member of the bishops in the House of Lords, and they can be pretty pointedly critical of governments. The church brings out various reports on various social issues, which are often quite critical. So I'm not saying that the church isn't critical. I'm saying that by clinging on to the apparatus of privilege that is what establishment brings, its imagination is confined, and very often its sense that it has to put its loyalty to the state first prevents it from adopting what I would regard as authentically Christian positions. One example of that would be the service held in Westminster Abbey just a few years ago to mark the 50th anniversary of the nuclear deterrence. This was held in Westminster Abbey, presided over by the Dean of the Cathedral, at a time when General Sidov had passed a motion virtually denouncing the possession of nuclear weapons. So this is part of the legacy of establishment. And if we remain as an established church, there will always be pressures like this to conduct events like that, which I think are fundamentally compromising of the church's integrity.
Catherine Pepys, do you think that if the church was disestablished, it would be freer to promote the true Christian message?
It's difficult to ascertain in some ways because the Church of England is so embedded in this British society because of its role. If it was no longer the established church, one thing I think that would happen pretty quickly if it was disestablished was that it would not feel the responsibility to be so present across the country. It would start, I think, closing down a lot of churches that aren't that well attended on a Sunday morning. However, the function of the Church of England isn't just about Sunday morning. It has a role locally as being part of the neighbourhood. Other churches do this too, but the Church of England, because it is so present and has numerous buildings, plays a huge function in providing food banks or helps the elderly. It does all kinds of things like that. A lot of that would go because those premises wouldn't be there, because they wouldn't feel the responsibility to be in every neighbourhood in the same way.
But with great respect, Catherine, as a Roman Catholic, you know that the Archdiocese of Westminster, for example, has got a brilliant record in terms of food banks and other things. There are a massive number of Roman Catholic churches throughout the country that are doing
that, and
tremendous social work.
No, I agree, but I'm just saying that the Church of England, because it's so present, does so much of it, and a lot of that would go. I think that in a flash, they would close down a lot of their churches. So I think that would be
an
issue.
Jonathan, yes.
Can I respond to Catherine there? So I think I disagree with Catherine on this issue. People often distinguish between high establishment and earthed establishment. What Catherine is talking about is earthed establishment. That's the presence of the church in local communities. I affirm that, and, you know, in my way, I'm part of it. I don't want that to be lost, and I do not think that it would be lost in the case of breaking up high establishment. The church is going to continue to be located in local communities. There's no reason whatsoever why a change in its constitutional status should suddenly cause it to either close churches or withdraw from local communities. Why would it ever do that? It's going to continue to maintain the same theology of incarnation and mission that it's always had or tried to have. No reason whatsoever why, for example, removing bishops from the House of Lords or ending a religious coronation or abolishing the ecclesiastical committee, which are light years away from what happens in local communities, would make any difference on the ground. So I would want to say, let's deal with high establishment. Let's break up that apparatus, which is anachronistic, inequitable, and stifling, and maintain the presence of the church in local communities. There's no reason whatsoever why there needs to be a damaging impact at that level at all. That depends on the church's own commitment to its theology of local mission.
Now, because we don't have a written constitution, it's fiendishly complicated to disentangle all of this and the question of the bishops in the second chamber. Should you have a second chamber? But how does King Charles III see his role now? Would he fight to the death, as it were, to maintain the Church of England as an established church? Or is he much more relaxed about these things, do you think? Do we know what sort of defender of the faith, supreme governor, he will be?
I think he's pretty much signed up to the project. Some years ago, as I understand it, there was quite a lot of sort of disaffection there, and it was tied up with what he viewed as the Church of England's antipathy and towards him over his marital problems and the lack of the sympathy for him. But it seems to me, as he's got closer and closer to the day he takes over, and now it's happened, that he's signed up far more, and he stressed in several statements that he made soon after becoming king that he's a committed Anglican. He's referred to the oath he's going to take at the coronation to ensure the settlement of the Church of England. So he seems in that sense to be very much part of it, yes.
Jonathan, what do you think he will do as king in terms of the Anglican Church?
It's a bit difficult to predict in that he hasn't played a particularly prominent role in church affairs over the years, but that comes with the office, nor has the Queen. The Queen has kept a distance from the management of the Church of England, obviously. She's expressed sentiments about how the Church of England should continue to act as a kind of umbrella for all faiths, and insofar as the Church can do that, then it should do that, and I hope he will continue to do that. I think we've every reason to think that he will do. He's a person of wide sympathies, very considerable knowledge of religion, far greater than I think any member of the royal family that we've probably ever had before. So I'm quite optimistic about his role as a convener of religious faiths and a supporter of religious faiths across the UK. I'm happy to encourage him in that. We can expect good things from that. There will possibly be tensions between that role and his membership of the Church of England and his supreme governorship. Those, I think, will largely be conducted behind closed doors. It's unlikely, I think, they'll ever break out into the open. But I think that's what we can expect of his reign in this regard. And whether or not the church remains established, this is what we expect a constitutional monarch of a diverse country like the UK to do. So in a sense, it's the question of what kind of a king he will be can be distinguished and really separated from the question of the future of the establishment of the Church of England. Church of England could be disestablished in whole or in part over the next number of years. That would be my hope. But the monarchy will continue. It'll be a different kind of monarchy. It'll be a civil monarchy rather than a sacral monarchy. But the king can continue, and other members of the royal family can continue to do many of the good things, all of the good things that they've been doing over many years. And you know, to that extent, the nation can be grateful for that.
Can I finally raise a question? Well, slightly difficult question, but it's this. We're not only crowning a king, we're crowning a queen. And we're not having a queen consort. And we have as Queen Camilla someone whom we know is divorced, who was having an affair with Charles while he was still married. There are a large number of people in the country, I suspect, who see Princess Diana as the wronged woman and so on. And certainly the coverage of all of that has blown apart the ability of us to see the royal family as somehow some moral exemplars, a perfect family, if you like. Three of the four children of the late Queen divorced. Our reverence for them as moral lights, really, that's a way. The power of the monarchy in real power has largely gone. So the role left, in a way, is, as Catherine is saying, a unifying presence. But do you think there's still value in it being a unifying Christian presence?
I find that quite difficult to answer because, for me, it does work as a unifying Christian presence. And Christianity, isn't it about being exemplars in that way? And I mean, the royal family went down that route since the time about George III, thinking that they should be this exemplar, they should represent domestic rectitude, and it just doesn't work anymore. But Christianity is about people who are deeply flawed finding redemption. So I don't think that there's a problem in that way with them being flawed.
But it's about respect, isn't it? It's about, you know, when I was anyway much younger, and it was partly out of ignorance because the Queen was this far-off figure, we didn't have the sort of press intrusion and so on that we had before. You could almost project onto the Queen anything you like. What was visible was a Christian commitment to service. But for the rest, you could, as it were, project whatever you wanted on it. And those who wanted to project goodness and a moral example could do so. All I'm saying is now, as a result of the behaviour of the royals, but partly because the exposure in the contemporary world, that's no longer possible, is it?
They can stand for other things beyond sort of domestic issues. We're talking about service, and they can stand for sort of being people that try to do their best despite their flaws. I don't think that's an issue for me, anyway. We have to accept that we are far more of a divided nation in that they have far more critics than they once would have done, the royal family, and there are certain critics who will never be swayed, whatever they do.
You respect the office, but it becomes increasingly difficult when Prince Harry reveals all about his upbringing or whatever, to particularly respect some of the individuals. This shouldn't matter in a way, but surely it does matter in terms of general attitudes, because we have elevated them, in the past at least, to a position that no one can live up to.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned Prince Harry, because Prince Harry is not a working royal. So what people will focus more on is what somebody like the Princess Royal does in the work that she does to a considerable degree. And I think also, picking up on something she was actually saying herself in an interview with Canadian media the other day, she talked about the monarchy providing continuity and stability. And I think those are important issues for the country. A lot of people thought when Elizabeth II died, she'd been queen for so long, she was part of the furniture, and people would be absolutely traumatised when she was no longer with us. Well, I don't think people have been. And one reason why is that we have the facility to have continuity. The accession of Charles provided us with a certain stability. And remember when that happened? We had that extraordinary political craziness at that time. The Queen shook the hand of Boris Johnson and the hand of Liz Truss as one went and the other came in. And then within a few weeks, not long after she died, we had Rishi Sunak. Turmoil, political turmoil. But meantime, the monarchy provided continuity and stability. And that was highlighted by that political turmoil.
And Jonathan, I often hear from people of minority faiths and so on that they are glad that at the centre of the British state is the Church of England, because it ensures that faith is at the heart of events. And they also feel that it's a sort of protection, that they themselves are safer with religion at the heart of the state. Do you think there's any validity to that?
Oh, there is indeed, and there's considerable empirical confirmation of that. You know, studies have shown that the vast majority of representative leaders of minority faiths, although we shouldn't call them minorities anymore, so some of them are outnumbering Christians, are entirely happy with the establishment for that very reason. Now, my response to that would be to say those concerns should not be dismissed. Those minority faiths still feel fragile and are subject to various kinds of marginalization. So governments and parliament needs to act decisively to reassure minority faiths of their equal public standing in British society. Whether establishment is the way to do that is another question. I don't think it is.
And Catherine Pevensey, I wonder how Catholics would feel if, in the end, the Church of England was disestablished. I remember the late Cardinal Hume once saying that, and very much surprising me when he said it, that he felt an outsider in some ways. It was possible to feel as a Roman Catholic an outsider. Would you feel better, if you like, if your church was on an equal status as that of the Church of England? Or are you happy for it to remain associated in the way it is?
I think there's great value in being outsider, so I would not want the Catholic Church to be in any way established in this country. But it's interesting that he said that, because if you talk to Archbishops of Westminster, which I've done on various occasions, they usually say, interesting, you know, the Jonathan said the same about minority religions, they usually say that they rather like the Church of England being where it is in this country, as an established church, because they feel that it is ensuring that faith has a place in the public square. So for them, that's an important thing. Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who replaced Cardinal Hume after Cardinal Hume died, at one point was invited to join the House of Lords alongside those Anglican bishops, but it didn't happen, and partly it didn't happen because Catholic canon law would not allow it. Catholic canon law feels that you shouldn't get into bed too closely with politicians. It could all go pear-shaped and you could end up having to do things you don't want to do. One of the things that's very interesting about the established church in this country is that although it is established, it also can often be the grit in the oyster. The bishops in the House of Lords, the Anglican bishops, often seem to get under the skin of other politicians in a way which I find rather appealing.
There are a number of people I've talked to in the House of Lords who, for example, Jonathan, would greatly miss the bishops. What they do is ensure that ethical and spiritual issues are raised, and they do represent, of course, the former chief rabbi may be there as well, but they do represent a wider interest, religious interest. And if they were not there at the centre of the Lords, at the centre of the Constitution, these issues would not be raised, and that the moral and ethical debate in the country would be impoverished. So even if you argue it's illogical where we are, it's a fault of history, if you like, you're absolutely confident that if disestablishment happened, that it would still be the case that at the centre of our political debates, a spiritual and religious understanding would be present.
Well, not absolutely confident, because that depends on what would replace the Lord's spiritual, what alternatives there are. And so I'm not simply making a negative case to abolish things. I'm trying to make a positive case for robust, comprehensive, well-resourced Christian engagement in public life at all levels, including in House of Commons and the House of Lords. So, for example, you could envisage a reformed House of Lords, which needs reforming for lots of other reasons as well, and we might be soon entering into a period of reform of the House of Lords, certainly if there's a change of government. You could envisage a system in which a variety of religious faiths and denominations could nominate representatives to sit in that reformed House of Lords. That way you could maintain, indeed possibly enrich, a variety of religious voices. And the other reform that would need to take place is that the church would have to take much more seriously its training of its lay people in politics. I mean, there are large numbers of Christians in Parliament already, including in the House of Lords, many of whom already maintain high levels of debate and make faith-based contributions to debates in both chambers. That's great. They need support. They need resourcing. They need training. So why not devote the resources that are currently exclusively directed to 26 diocesan bishops, who are really far too busy for that kind of a role anyway and don't necessarily have any background that's relevant to it, reach out that towards equipping a new generation of parliamentarians to speak articulately of faith across the board in both chambers of Parliament.
Are you persuaded by that, Catherine Pepinster?
I think it's potentially possible. Unpacking establishment with the Church of England, dealing with it, will take the most extraordinary amount of legal work as well, if they're going to do it, and then have a different coronation next time round, which can't be that far off given the age of the king. They need to get on with it.
Can I speculate, Roger? Do we have time for me to
speculate
on what that alternative...
Yes, speculate.
This is not original to me, but a number of commentators have said that what we need really is a civil investiture ceremony, which would be akin to what takes place in other European monarchies. So it wouldn't take place in the context of a religious service or in a church or cathedral. It would take place in a place such as Westminster Hall, which, of course, is absolutely brimming with historical resonance and meaning. You wouldn't have the interior of a Westminster Abbey, but you would have the majestic interior of a Westminster Hall, for example, presided over by, for example, the President of the Supreme Court, representing the authority of the Constitution in the UK and sending the signal that the monarch stands within and under the Constitution, as do his or her governments. Now, there you could have all kinds of expressions of inclusivity without the confinements of Anglican canon law. So you could have people from different nations, different generations, from civil society, from different religious groups. You could do the whole show, if you like. And then, here's the other critical suggestion. The Church of England, ideally in cooperation with other churches, Catholic Church and non-conformist churches, could then offer its own voluntary service of blessing consecration at a later date. That could take place in Westminster Abbey, it could take place in Westminster Cathedral, it could take place in Westminster Central Hall. There are different locations. There you could replicate almost all of the rich theological content that we are going to see performed on Saturday. So there wouldn't be any loss of theological meaning.
So Catherine Pepperson, you've got a sort of two-part coronation proposed there. One, as it were, Westminster Hall, and the second one, who knows, maybe in Westminster Cathedral, let alone Westminster Abbey. Do you think that would... has attractions to you?
Well, I think having a civil ceremony as well would be fine. But then I don't see why you shouldn't still have the coronation in the Church of England. If the king, the monarch, was patron of the Church of England rather than supreme governor, it could have that sort of relationship with the Church of England. I don't see why he shouldn't then be crowned in Westminster Abbey as before. And that would our heritage that kings and queens have been crowned there since 1066. So I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Now, we do say at the end of the service, of course, long live the king. But as you pointed out, he is in his middle 70s. Do you think there will be another coronation, Jonathan Chaplin? Say, when they look at it in 15 years' time or 10 years' time, we will actually say, no, we no longer want a coronation. We still want a monarchy.
I can answer that in two ways, what I would hope for and what I would predict. I would certainly hope for that, because I think it would be theologically much more authentic and missiologically much more authentic for the church and politically more equitable and sustainable for the state. So I would hope that, but I can't say I'm optimistic that that's going to happen, because at the moment there just is not the groundswell of opinion either in church or state to even start thinking about this question. So I suspect we will probably have at least one more sacral coronation, but maybe that will be the last.
Do you think if this is not the last, will the next one be the last, Catherine Pepinstone? Last coronation?
It's a difficult one to assess. What certainly would be a good idea would be to have the debate, and that debate needs to start as soon as this one is over. I'm not suggesting we have some great, you know, public forum, but I think the people involved need to discuss what went on May the 6th and think about it seriously and think about whether that can be replicated again or whether they need to rethink what it's about. And do they want to find a way of having more involvement of other faiths and more involvement of other churches? They suggested that they wanted it to be very much more ecumenical. Well, it's not particularly. I mean, the representatives of other Christian denominations between them say just 90 words. It's not much at all. There were not the restrictions on involving them as there were on other faiths. So that suggests to me that the Church of England was very firm, that it really wanted to be in pole position. And I think that it's as much the Church of England as Buckingham Palace that need to think about, do we need to relinquish something?
So finally, we've talked about issues of establishment, about the history, about the meaning of the coronation, its significance, whether it will continue. But what's its appeal? Will you be watching, Jonathan?
I will certainly be watching the coronation. I have a professional interest in these things, so I'm very keen to see how it plays out. I've read the liturgy now, and it's going to be fascinating how that is received. I will be watching it. I'm a loyal Anglican. I'm a moderate supporter of the monarchy. I'm not driven by hostility to either institution, but I will certainly be hoping that after this day, there will be some serious reconsideration of the relationship that they find themselves in.
And finally, Catherine Pepinster, if you weren't professionally engaged, would you set aside everything to watch the coronation?
Yes, I think so. If nothing else, out of curiosity, because there hasn't been one in my lifetime. So, you know, I'll be interested to see what it's about. There's a way in which people have become far more aware of the connection between church and crown in the last 100 years. Because of the media, we have been used to seeing the late Queen and her family attending Christmas Day and Easter services. There was the invention of the Christmas message, first on the wireless and later on TV. That started in the 1930s. They've appeared at countless Thanksgiving services. Their weddings are on TV for us all to watch. And years ago, the idea that the royal family's weddings would be public moments, that just wasn't around. So we've seen more of them involved with religion in that way than previous generations ever would have done, which is interesting that that's happened at the same time as belief in the religion that they follow has declined. So if anybody thinks that having a royal family is part of a kind of missionary endeavour of the Church of England, well, it hasn't worked.
Well, Catherine Pepinster, thank you very much, and also Jonathan Chaplin. Catherine is the author of The British Monarchy, Religion and the Next Coronation, and Dr. Jonathan Chaplin has written Beyond Establishment, Resetting Church and State Relations in England. Thank you both very much for joining us for this edition, and I hope people will join us again next time. Thank you. Thanks very much to Catherine Pepinster and to Dr. Jonathan Chaplin, and thank you too for listening. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via our social media at unbelievable, capital F, capital E, for Twitter, or facebook.com/premier unbelievable if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page. And of course, you can find all these links to all our shows and content on our website, premierunbelievable.com.